William Rayford is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Rayford to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. The Execution Watch for William Rayford begins.
Okay, my name is Ray Hill, and this is the beginning of our show. Usually we have a little Panetti music, but there's a computer glitch going on somewhere. Bob's doing the best he can to fix it for the end of the show. So tonight they're killing. I think we have an operating stay. We won't actually know until we get the report on whether the witnesses are crossing the road, but I think there's still a matter pending before the Supreme Court of the United States. So I'm going to take a little minute to explain what happens when that happens. If there is a pending matter before the United States Supreme Court, then what happened? And by the way, now Texas cases go to Justice Alito. Prior, it went to Scalia. And every once in a while, Judge Scalia will look at the case and then take the case from there. And he said, well, I don't want to pull this decision by myself. And so he would poll the other justices. The justices are not sitting in their offices waiting for these things when they happen. As a matter of fact, as we approach this, the justice in charge, in this case would be Justice Alito, is carefully briefed on the case by a clerk whose job it is to do that. Now, nationally, the business of execution is very good. There's executions going on in Virginia and in Georgia right now, and we're back-to-back in Texas. We have execution tonight, another scheduled for Thursday. So that particular clerk is exercising a very busy period of his professional life. But Judge Alito has been alerted of this case, given the details of it, and he can make the decision to proceed or not all by himself. If he chooses to bring in other justices, that takes more time. Now, originally we started out with Justice Scalia being our managing justice. And when Justice Scalia was our managing justice, we paid attention to what he had to say. And every once in a while, there would be a stay. Then when he died, he was replaced by Justice Thomas, and Justice Thomas took over. And Justice Thomas sometimes was out to dinner when somebody happened, but he rarely sought the advice of the rest of the court. He had thumbs up and thumbs down all by himself. And now, after the new appointment to the Supreme Court, our justice would be Justice Alito, and he hasn't been with us long enough to develop a pattern. So I see right now Pat Hartwell has called in from Huntsville. Pat, are you there?
I am.
What's going on?
We're sitting here waiting on the Supreme Court to rule, and I hope Justice Alito does ask the rest of the justices their opinion. Maybe something will come of it.
Well, we haven't had Justice Alito long enough to perceive a pattern. I was actually surprised at how frequently Justice Scalia sought other justices' opinion. That happened quite frequently when he was in charge.
Well, maybe he'd had one too many beers, right?
Well, I don't think he wanted the thumbs up and thumbs down by himself. And so that's when you would go to that. Now, I don't think we had that problem with Justice Thomas. I think Justice Thomas is perfectly willing to exercise his thumbs in these cases.
Well, exactly, and I think a decision in a death penalty case should take all of the justices. I don't think one person should be responsible for it. That's why we have a justice system.
Well, I think in regular course of direct and writ appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States, more justices are involved in the process. At the end of the process, where I call it playing chicken, because you wait until the last minute and you throw everything you have at the wall and hope something will stick. And in that case, it runs up there, and they may not even be in session, but somebody's going to be in the building. And those cases are a little different from more deliberate appeals. And this is one of those things. It's execution night, and there's pending matters that have not been resolved. But no witnesses are crossing the road as far as you can see.
Oh, no. Nothing. It's still daylight out here. Nothing's crossing. They won't cross. They're still in that little bitty room till that phone rings.
Okay.
And they won't cross. I'm out here. Gloria and Joanne's out here, the professor. And a couple of other people, and we have two young women that have come down from Sam Houston that seem real interested, and Gloria and I were talking to them, and they seem appalled at this race thing and the jury, and we were telling them some stats about how many people of color were on death row and how it worked, and, you know, for the person that's not used to all of this, it is appalling.
We'll give our regards to the vigilance and be prepared to call us back if something happens.
I sure will, Ray. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. And that's bye-bye. Pat Hartwell, an anti-death penalty activist of long standing, and we appreciate her services in Huntsville. Jack, what happened in this case?
Well, it's Rayford. Rayford had gone to his ex-girlfriend's house. They at 6:30 in the morning. They'd broken up several months previous. He used to live in the house. She ended up having to kick him out. And well, he used a key that he had to get into the house. Now, this key had been a bone of contention between him and his ex-girlfriend Hall. So Rayford walks in, and there's a confrontation between Hall and Rayford, the Rayford and his ex-girlfriend, and he starts hitting her. She calls out for her son, Thomas, Benjamin Thomas, to come help her. And as he comes out, Rayford stabs Thomas in the back several times.
The son?
Yes. And, you know, keep in mind, this is an adult son.
Okay.
He was 12?
Okay, so, at any rate, Thomas runs out. Meanwhile, Rayford and Hall are struggling. Rayford throws Hall over. Hall runs out. Rayford beats her. Chases after her, beats her up, throws her over his shoulder, and carries her off. Now, we know this because there was a bus driver, Johnson, who was stopped at a corner and saw all of this happen. Saw that Hall was flipped over the back of Rayford. She was struggling, and Rayford carried her off, eventually the body was lifeless until he made it past some houses and back to out of sight of Johnson. Now, what's interesting about this case is that Johnson was used as a defense witness, with the idea that perhaps Hall was already dead before she was carried off. That's something we'll get into
would
later.
Would that have made any difference in the kidnapping case?
It could have. It's a capital murder if if it's kidnapping and then there's a murder, okay? If it's if you just happen to kill somebody, it's just murder. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make light of that.
No. You're not making light of it. We're trying to sort out the weeds here.
But and so eventually, when Rayford comes out, he's shivering, he's cold. Apparently, what happened was Rayford had dragged her into a culvert pipe, a large drainage pipe, and meanwhile keep beating her, stabbing her with glass, and so on, until she died. Well, until she was very close to death.
Okay.
And he ended up being taken to the hospital. At the hospital, he had cut his knee, and while at the hospital, they treated him, and the police and one of the investigators came and started speaking to him and asked, "Can I take samples off of your sweater?" And he said yes. And lo and behold, there was Hall's DNA and Hall's blood all over the sweater, as well as his own.
And apparently Thomas's.
That's correct. That's correct. A lot of folks' blood on his sweater. And so, frankly, there was all the evidence at that point that they needed.
So there's no issue here about guilt or innocence?
There really isn't. There really isn't.
Okay. Wasn't he sentenced for a previous homicide?
Yes, yes. What had previously happened, he had gone into his ex-wife's...
Wait a minute. This is the ex-girlfriend. But
no.
The first one is the ex-wife.
Okay. That's correct. The ex-wife, and he had killed his ex-wife. They had already broken up in front of her children.
Her children.
There's always children involved with him. It was 11 out of 11 stab wounds, 6 were fatal.
Wow.
With his ex-wife. And he it wasn't a capital murder because there are certain delineated crimes that have to be committed as a part and parcel to the murder.
And trespassing and is not likely to be one of them.
No. At any rate, he was charged and convicted for murder, went to prison, paroled out, and he was on parole when he killed Hall.
And both of these cases are Dallas cases.
That's correct.
And Henry Wade's the district attorney.
Well,
it is rumored that Henry does not like repeat homicide business.
Well, Henry was definitely the DA for the 86, the first murder.
Yeah.
I'm not certain whether or not Henry was still...
Yes, Henry was still there because Watson did not come in until later. Yeah, I remember when Watson came. Okay. We celebrated all over the state.
I did. Well, you would know better than I.
But the one thing about Henry is Henry kept all of the evidence. So if you had a DNA question come up decades later, here's the box and there's the samples.
Well, good for Henry.
Yeah, well, Henry was a mixed bag. I was at a forum where he and Johnny Holmes were speaking. And of course, I'm a big anti-execution activist and I'm out there preaching my sermon, and Johnny said, "Well, don't you think that the way to get rid of the capital punishment is to vigorously prosecute it and let the public speak out against it, and that would give you the political fodder?" And Henry Wade sitting over there like a bobble doll, shaking his head, yeah. And it kind of takes the wind out of your sails.
Well, Mr. Holmes had the ability to take the wind out of many people's sails.
As he twirled his mustache. How much of the evidence from the first trial were they allowed to get into the second trial? All of it?
Well, I mean, the first what they would bring in mostly is it was during the punishment phase.
Okay.
All right.
So guilt and innocence is not much
of a
crime.
Really,
so they brought in an actual witness to the crime as a defense witness to kind of mitigate, but that didn't come in until punishment either.
Correct. Yeah.
That didn't come in guilt or innocence. It came in punishment. Yeah.
So, at any rate, I'd like Larry to talk about specifically something that you brought up. What difference would it have made?
If the case had been reversed.
Well, no, where Hall had been.
This is a kidnapping
died.
By backpack.
I'm sorry?
This is kidnapping by backpack.
Kidnapping by backpack would be one way of talking about it.
He threw her over his shoulder and he kidnapped her on foot.
Right. One of the defense arguments was that Hall had actually died 150 feet outside of the culvert pipe. And. I'd like Larry to talk about whether that would have made a difference.
What says the evidence?
Well, Ray, the real reason that
wait a minute, we got to get a microphone here. Come on, Bob.
In order for this to be a death penalty case, as Jack has mentioned, there have to be certain specific statutory requirements, and this is a kidnapping. The statutory language says in the course of committing. Okay, and then they list various different offenses that makes the case a death case, because if the murder is committed in the course of committing certain enumerated other felonies, then it becomes a death case. In this case, in the course of committing a aggravated kidnapping case. So the Rayford raised the question on appeal that the evidence was not legally and factually sufficient for him to be death eligible, because the issue of having committed the offense in the course of the kidnapping, he argues, had not been sufficiently proven. That is, when you look at the evidence, his claim is that there may have been a kidnapping. And there may have been a murder, but was the murder committed in the course of committing the kidnapping? Was there something that intervened that broke the chain between the murder and the kidnapping?
And he expects a Dallas jury to sort that out.
The Dallas jury, according to the appeals court, did sort that out. Okay. And their verdict was upheld, because when the appeals court looked at it, and looked at the totality of the circumstances, what we have here is that William Rayford goes to Carol Hall's house, and he kidnaps her. Okay, he takes her away
over his shoulder.
They go to great pains to discuss to define the definition of kidnapping.
Okay,
that is that he took her away. She was not free to leave. Okay. And what happened was, you know, when he goes into her house, he beats her, takes her away, stabs her 12-year-old son. She runs to her mother's house, and he catches her before she gets there, and he beats her some more. Another witness comes by and sees this, and sees the man has beat a woman, and he thinks that she may have been lifeless. But he didn't see anything after that. So the concern is, where did the murder occur? At least that's the issue that Rayford's lawyers are raising, in the hope that perhaps we can make something out of this. If we can get an appeals court to say that it was not committed in the course of the kidnapping, then it's not a capital murder, it's just a murder. And so that's an effort to save the client's life. By trying to convince that perhaps there is a legal or factual insufficiency argument that we can persuade the court of, and if we can do that, then we're home free, at least for the murder.
If you're the defense lawyer, that's what you do. You look for an escape from the capital sentence by any means necessary.
That's the task that the defense lawyer has, in this case, the appellate lawyer has, is to say, when you look at all this evidence, there may have been a break. It all depends upon where the murder occurred. Well, the court looks
at
all of that.
The murder is when she died.
The murder is when she died, when he caused her death. Okay. And his the appeals court actually just flushed the whole argument. Their response was, when you look at all this evidence, the totality of the evidence, it really doesn't make a difference whether she died before entering into the culvert, whether she died in the culvert, or whether she died, you know, even after he'd left. Because right after this whole thing occurred, they were looking for her body, and they couldn't find it. He shows back up. Okay, he shows back up.
Wait. Now, this has all happened, and he's gone away somewhere.
He's gone away. They're looking for him, looking for her.
And he shows up with a bloody sweater.
He shows back up, okay? And so he's still in the general vicinity the whole time. But the whole issue of in the course of committing the kidnapping, the murder occurring, that was the one of the issues that is appellate lawyers raised. And that's, again, to raise the issue, maybe there is a legal insufficiency argument that can be made. Maybe there's a factual insufficiency argument that can be made. Perhaps he kidnapped her and the kidnapping might have been complete and then the murder occurred. Okay. So if there was some intervening factor, some circumstance that caused one to be separated from the other, because that's really the way the capitals are made. And I talk a lot about prosecutorial discretion. They didn't have to seek the death penalty in this case. And I think a lot of the motivating factor for seeking the death penalty is that he killed the ex-wife. Okay.
The previous homicide.
And
it's very interesting. The previous homicide happened in the 1980s, and he was released about 1976. 1996.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, but at any rate, he was in prison less than 10 years on that sentence.
And the facts of that case are so similar to the facts of this case. That is, him having killed his ex-wife in the presence of her children. And these kinds of cases are really seen as being particularly nasty domestic violence cases.
Oh, yeah. A prosecutor can paint an ugly picture with the kids.
And these kinds of cases, I mean, Harris County now has a special division, as most counties do, called the Family Criminal Law Division, to pursue these kinds of cases. Because they're sort of viewed as special kinds of cases. And had it not been for the fact that he had killed that he'd been convicted, he pled guilty and was convicted of the murder of the ex-wife. Having pled guilty to that, and who knows what those circumstances were, but what prosecutors do when they decide to seek the death penalty is they have to find some justification under the statute. And I have no idea whether there was any kidnapping or anything of that sort involved. But in this case, they had to decide, do we want to seek death? Because they really didn't have to do so.
Do you think there's a jurisdiction in the state that would not have sought death in this case?
When you consider that he was not really that big a danger in prison.
It was a danger to women he dealt with, apparently.
If he's in prison, he would not have been, I think I read somewhere.
No, in prison, I don't think there's not any women there.
I read someplace that he would have been 86 years old.
Oh, correct. That's correct.
If he had been sentenced to life rather than giving the death penalty, so he was not going to murder another woman was involved in a relationship with.
Now he's a big fella. He's 6 foot something. Where did I see that?
Which also is scary. Okay, it weighs on, you know, if a jury sees him sitting there.
Yeah, 6'4".
They take that into consideration. The
jury takes everything into consideration.
And the other thing is, Carol Hall was pretty much defenseless You know, she calls for a 12-year-old son to come and help her, and he stabs him in the back. Then she tries to run, and he catches up with her. Then he throws her over his shoulder, which means that, you know, he's a big, strong man, and she's a small woman, and carries her into a culvert. But the whole issue of factual and legal sufficiency, trying to break the connection between the kidnapping and the murder, while it's something that I think the appellate lawyers had to argue, the court just flushed that right away.
Dave, from reading the case and the appeals, were his lawyers adequate, doing the best they can?
Oh, I think they were doing an excellent job with what they had presented to them. I truly believe that this case was unable to be won from the very start, based upon his previous criminal history, and then the facts of the second murder being so similar to the facts of the first murder.
Apparently, when women tried to get away from him, he was rather possessive of them.
Yes,
that a fair thing to say?
He would take offense at that. Yeah.
It sounds like typical bully behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we see that in politics these days too.
Well, yes.
Yeah. But, Jack, in your research of this case, did you find any exceptional stuff going on in the trial or in any of the appeals?
Not really. I mean, okay, there was an issue about a veneerman. A juror who, and Mike was going to talk about that.
Mike, what you got on that?
Well, what I was going to talk about is kidnapping.
Okay.
I'm a lawyer, but I still think kidnapping is a crime of itself for financial rewards. I don't know how you can...
In other words, you want to kidnap somebody to get a reward.
Restraining somebody's liberty. If I'm going to kill you and ask you to move off the sidewalk, is that kidnapping? Restraining somebody's liberty, it's all he did. My pitch to this... And I'm not saying that this is successful, but this is a bad case. The only thing that I see to attack this is by claiming he was a husband.
Really?
I'm not saying the facts back it, but when I see a three-year relationship, I see he lives in a house. Common law marriage does not take much besides
holding
out. No,
common law marriage doesn't need a ceremony and a license.
And more than that, we don't know how much money...
But it does require... holding yourselves out as being married, which they didn't, or at least there is no evidence that
anybody could have testified.
The absence of evidence is not evidence.
We can sort this out.
The fact that the lawyer didn't think about it,
the absence of evidence,
I know,
is not evidence.
If I'm the lawyer, there would have been somebody testifying that he introduced.
What difference would it made if this had been a relationship, common law or otherwise?
I think it's an argument that it wasn't a burglary, that it wasn't a kidnapping, it was a murder.
It was a murder. And
you can kidnap your wife.
Yes. And he had been evicted.
All right. If you're going to talk, wait for a microphone.
You cannot be evicted by an uncle.
Okay.
If I'm in a relationship with a woman, and I consider ourselves married, and I'm paying the rent, and I'm paying the bills, the uncle can't kick me out.
There's no evidence that rent was paid.
Were you saying there's no evidence in the record, or there was no evidence the lawyer presented? I saw nothing in the record. I said, if I'm the lawyer, I'm looking
look
at that
them?
Angle,
sure.
Because that's all I got.
And when you're defending people, you've got to use everything that's within your power to do. Okay, so if there was some way...
Yeah, you don't.
This is being a kidnapping. Then it's a murder, not a capital.
If you're especially in an appointed case, and I assume this is an appointed case.
In all likelihood.
Yeah, you don't necessarily get to pick your clients, do you? You've got to go in there and do what John Adams did. Is I've got to represent these mm-hmm. British soldiers, no matter what I thought about what they were doing and when they were doing it.
And again, the evidence is nothing.
A little
more
closer to the microphone.
The evidence is nothing more than a statement that I consider myself married, and that's evidence.
And an argument like that, I would imagine, could be made just as effectively.
Well, he didn't take the stand because of the previous case.
Well, I mean, just as effectively as the factual and legal sufficiency regarding whether there was a kidnapping or not. So if you're going to attack kidnapping, attack it on all grounds is what Mike is saying, which makes perfect sense to me. Now, I'm not saying it would have been successful.
And some of it may not.
What I have found is...
You get it in the record... So the appellate lawyers can juggle it.
Exactly.
Where men screw up is they put their wife on health insurance. They'll deduct married on their W-2 form to get more money back. They'll do to save a few bucks and get them married. I think that there's an argument that is a common law marriage. I think that argument makes it a whole different case.
But it was not used in this case.
And maybe because... There were specific facts I don't know about, like she was filing a separate tax return, which would diffuse any argument of him claiming.
Or maybe the only tax return.
We don't know. All I'm saying is I would look into that because I don't know what else you can do. I also don't think he knew about the bus driver. I think he came back because he thought nobody saw what he did.
So all speculation aside, let me talk about the veneer man.
Okay.
So, first, a
veneerman is somebody on a panel to be selected from for the jury.
At any rate, she was supposed to talk. There was a potential issue that she had already made up her mind about a death penalty because one of her comments was that murder should be met with murder. That anybody who commits a murder needs to be put to death, and. For lack of better words, the legal fiction that our system has put together is you're asked when that happens, if you say something, say something that doesn't comport with the law, you're asked, can you put aside your own feelings, your own opinions, your own views,
and comply
and put your feelings aside and do as you are told. According to the law.
A trial is not about your opinion. Correct. A trial is about what evidence is presented to you and how you interpret
Correct.
It.
And she said yes. And when you're on appeal, any kind of appeal, the evidence and the record is seen in light most conducive that supports the verdict. And in this case, the judge simply, talked to her, and his conclusion.
Now, what happens if a veneerman lets out something like, "I think that every homicide should result in an execution"?
Right.
The judge just gives a motion, and everybody gathers up
Correct.
At the bench for a mumble session.
Well, in this case, it might have been more than just at the bench. It was probably in a closed doors.
Okay, in a closed doors, but there was a recorder.
Sure.
So all of this is part of the record.
Correct, correct.
And so she was called aside from the other jurors, and she was questioned about whether or not she can perform the duties of a juror, which is to put aside your personal stuff and deal with what is presented in the courtroom, permissible evidence before a jury.
Correct.
And some of that has been filtered and denied the jury. The judge gets to decide what you hear.
Correct.
And if he screws up, that's what the appeal is directly about.
That's correct. And in this case, go ahead, Paige.
The overwhelming issue about this one particular veneer person was whether or not a challenge for cause ought to have been granted, or whether her excusal from the panel was based upon a peremptory challenge because of an unjust denial of a challenge for cause.
Yeah, because both sides get to, I just don't like your dress, so you can't be here.
Yeah, basically, I don't like your dress, I don't like your shoes, go away.
A denial for cause is on an issue.
It's on a legal issue.
Yeah.
Yes. The juror is incapable of performing according to the law and under oath.
Okay.
So that would be the basis for a challenge for cause.
And in Texas, in a capital case, it requires a unanimous verdict. So what one of the jurors may believe and decide affects everything.
Well, and it's actually much more important than that, because if you get granted a challenge for cause, then you do not have to use one of your peremptory challenges to get rid of that objectionable juror. And a challenges for cause, once they are declared, are unlimited. You can have 150 challenges for cause, yeah, if you have 150 bad jurors.
Yep.
And Ray, this also is a capital case, so the jurors, the veneermen, are examined individually.
Yeah.
Not as a panel, as the lesser charges are.
Yeah, sure.
And so the real lots of veneermen preliminarily disqualify themselves by saying something that suggests that they are unwilling to,
some of them want to say that,
follow the law.
Oh,
and
exactly.
So when the judges or whoever wants them on, just you rehabilitate them by asking them the question. They can answer into the affirmative, yes, I will follow the law. And you just, of course you'll follow the law. You will consider everything. You consider all the evidence. But in the end, you will indeed follow. And it's kind of hard for a juror to say, I will not follow the law. You know, once you take the oath, you've got to follow the law.
I've seen Carol Weaver run through a jury panel like it had a diuretic. I just used to go down there and just watch him, because he was the famous lawyer that got rid of the whole jury panel, and they sent back to the jury room for another panel.
And in this case, Ray, when you consider that this is a capital murder appeal, so the appellate lawyers have to read through the whole record. Everything's on the record.
Yeah.
And so they've got to look through. And the jury selection process in the Capitol takes a long time. And they went through all of that and found one.
Yeah, in that appellate lawyer's case, he had one veneerman that made it to the jury that had some question about it. And so he wrote about that.
Exactly. And this is like Mike was saying, you start to use whatever you can to try to defend, and in this case on the appellate side, to try to keep death off your guy.
But that didn't work.
So far it hasn't, and I suspect that it will not.
Do we know what issues are before the Supreme Court? They looked pretty flimsy when I read them this afternoon.
And I'm not sure.
I read what was available in short form. And they're based on two other Supreme Court cases, but I didn't perceive a direct relationship.
It didn't. I remember scanning over it,
yeah,
and it did not. It really didn't look like it was anything substantial.
No, it really didn't look like they had any substantial.
Let me give the audience thank you. By the way, I forgot to thank you for listening to Execution Watch. It's a difficult show to listen to because, while we're talking about it, in most cases, somebody's being killed. And if we have an interview with that person, when we're playing that interview, as we will Thursday night, you will be hearing that person's voice probably as they are being killed. But tonight, we do not have word from Pat that the witnesses have crossed the road. And that means that Mr. Rayford is in the death chamber. He's strapped down. They have not put needles in his arms. They will not put the needles in his arms until the courts complete their process. But he is in the chamber. What do you got, Bob? No, that's what I figure.
We're still in a holding pattern.
I'm watching telephone, so I'm explaining to people what that means. If the Supreme Court hasn't ruled, they will not put the needles in his arm until the Supreme Court rules. And so then they get the witness across the room. And our mechanism for doing that is our producer, Elizabeth Stein, is in there on the internet covering what's happening at the Supreme Court. At the same time, we've got Pat Hartwell in Huntsville waiting to see if witnesses start crossing the road. Now, I can tell you something about the committed vigilance. I mean, there's Pat and Gloria and the professor, the usual suspects in that case are sitting there. They will be there until 10 minutes of midnight. Now, the Texas prison system says, don't tell us to kill somebody after 10 o'clock. But they have done that. They have done that.
Yes, we had an execution that happened at about 10:20 last year.
Yeah, I remember that case. We had finished our show at 7 o'clock, and we're going to finish this show at 7 o'clock. But as of this point, which is currently 6:30, none of the witnesses have crossed the road. So that means that the process has not begun. Mr. Rayford is laying there waiting decision of somebody in Washington, D.C. We know the process begins with Alito, but Alito may find something that he wants to consult the other justices for, and that'll cause discussions. And if those discussions are kind of confusing, then a stay will be issued. But until the timelines pass in Texas, and the timelines legally are between 6 and midnight, is when they kill people here. And Mr. Rayford is laying there, long chaplain's there, the warden who is the official executioner, the warden of the wall unit is the official executioner in Texas is there, and they're waiting to do whatever the courts order them to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Wanted to something that very often comes up on execution cases is the question of future dangerousness. Very often comes up, mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about this case is that future dangerousness didn't come up. It barely came up on the radar screen because I think it was just so apparent.
He had that previous murder.
Right. He was on parole for murder. He, after killing his ex-wife in front of her children, and then you have a very similar repeat of the same murder.
No, future dangerousness was not on the menu in this case. I mean, nobody discussed it substantially, and the reason they didn't is because I perceived that they felt that there was no issue there.
Right.
There was no way a jury was not going to find him to be future dangerousness simply because of his past behavior.
Sure.
One of the appeals I read indicated some Freudian stuff there, is that there was maybe some mitigating circumstances from his childhood and abuse that he had suffered and his years of being on drugs.
Well, you know, speaking of drugs, while he was on parole, he failed several drug programs, which I just thought,
it's been an alarm for somebody.
It was weird.
Well, and the Board of Pardons and Paroles generally tends to look more closely at people who are on parole for murder than they do people who are on parole for possession of a controlled substance. And I really could not understand how someone who had failed 3 or 4 drug tests hadn't sent up a red flag somewhere in the Board of Pardons and Paroles, but it hadn't, it appears.
I don't know. I think
Were there any mental health issues brought up at all?
No.
There was nothing in any of the records that we read.
I mean, this case looks fairly cut and dry.
Mike,
I'm sorry.
Small point. This is one of the few cases I've seen that talks about black and white photographs. It's a pet peeve of mine. I don't understand why they need color photographs in a gruesome murder trial. Do you remember the trial?
Well, I can tell you that George Parnham would black and white the color ones.
Well,
indeed he would.
We remember the trial in Harris County this summer where the jurors were throwing up in the jury box from the photographs? Well, black and white photographs technically show more details of a crime scene than color do, and they're not They do not excite people.
I've heard those arguments of George Burnham, and I find them convincing.
I think they're good ones. But this is the only case I've seen where they did that. They did black and white photographs.
Oh, okay. They actually did black and white.
110 black and white photographs in this case. While I'm saying it, you never see they do it, but they did it in this case. And it wasn't that horrible a crime scene.
Okay.
Not like the one this summer.
Yeah. But nevertheless, we have a conviction. We have multiple appeals that didn't work. And so Mr. William Rayford is sitting on a gurney waiting for a decision from Washington, D.C. as to whether he will live the night or not. I think that that hanging in the balance must be excruciating.
I wouldn't want to be there.
No, I don't think I'd volunteer to spend a vacation day sitting on a gurney waiting for somebody to decide whether I'm going to make it through the night.
I think that with many condemned people, it is the issue of having the care of your attorney to guarantee that you have some kind of delay that is so impressive, that is so overwhelming for the defendant involved. And, you know, I can see how it would be painful too, but I also think that it is somewhat reassuring to know that they're being cared for and that they have a lawyer that is representing them and has managed to make some court listen to them about some issue in their case. Yes?
Well, I mean, the job of the appellate lawyer, I guess this is the writ lawyer, is that what
Yes, it would be at this point.
The writ lawyer is to get in there and dig and find something and head through the courts. And they did that in this case. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a pending issue before the Supreme Court of the United States. You know, now, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed one of the appeals earlier. But even that can go higher to the Supreme Court. I don't know if they incorporate the issues of that appeal into the issues of already before the Supreme Court. How does that work, Larry?
Well, I was really thinking about something else, Ray.
Okay.
I apologize. Because Jack is serving his lead today, and he'd appointed Paige to discuss the issue of the search, that is the blood and other evidence that was
On his body.
And that was raised, it was a pretty well discussed issue that I found pretty interesting.
It was a hugely discussed issue at Guilt and Innocence. Basically, I'm going to summarize some and then I'll go into detail on other. But basically what had happened is that during the course of events from 6:30 in the morning until about 7:30, it appears.
7:30 in the morning?
In the morning when the defendant comes back out and at that moment is captured by the Dallas police. He was missing for about an hour.
Okay.
And the murder happened during this time period. The kidnapping happened during this time period. The 12-year-old child was stabbed during this time period. I mean, all of this is occurring in that 1 hour period. And there was the issue of they searched Mr. Rayford when he got to the hospital. There was the discussion about, you know, that they took samples and stuff after they gave him all of their warnings to him about this.
Did he direct them to the body?
There's no evidence that he did that. I think they found the body themselves. But Ray, when he shows back up, he's sweaty
and bloody
and covered in blood,
and he's injured. So they take him to the hospital. And they're treating him, and they're also asking him to sign a consent. And they gave him the warnings for the consent. And so what he was complaining about was, I should have been given Miranda-type warnings, rather than consent to search type warnings, and that's really the issue that he raised. They gave him the consent to search warrant, and he approved it. They warned him, but now the issue is raised. Should I have gotten Miranda-type warnings?
Okay.
And the appellate court summarily dismissed the issue about Miranda.
Right.
Absolutely summarily dismissed it.
Well, at this point, it's hot pursuit.
The rationale for
Miranda is just hilarious. You remember? Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
It was about, When they took samples and when they took the blood and the DNA, they didn't have a gun to him, so it was not gun pointed at him, so it wasn't coerced.
Well, and the
that was
point,
the state's position.
Yeah,
and
the comment about it didn't have a gun pointed to his head was to refute the claim that it was coerced.
Exactly.
So he was not coerced. He did so voluntarily. Now he may have been persuaded. We've got police right there.
Yeah.
But there's a chance that if they had given him Miranda type warnings, he probably would have gone along with that. But Miranda is inapplicable he's not making a statement.
You know, I've been arrested a lot, and I've never gotten a Miranda warning from a cop. I see a magistrate and get a Miranda warning.
That's because you weren't arrested on TV.
but I was.
But Ray, but
I get arrested on television all the time. I know the cameraman better than the cop does.
Okay.
Your arrest wasn't scripted.
Police do it all the time when they want to get a statement right there.
Okay. With their recorders running.
Yes, and sometimes no, because oftentimes the Miranda warnings might be given in writing, okay, if there's no video available.
Okay, we got incoming. Who's there? Okay, Leah, put her on. Pat, how are y'all holding up?
Well, we're still out here. It's obviously 10 till 7 now, and the Supreme Court has not ruled, and no witnesses have walked across.
I just told this audience that you and Gloria and the professor are stalwart. You'll be there till the last minute.
I was never joking when I say we stand here until we see the witnesses walk across. We don't joke about that. I know that Mr. Rayford has plenty of friends that he left on the row, and I hope to the dickens that he comes home to the row tonight. His friends. We just have
well,
to wait and see.
Well, we're going to be off the air in about 10 minutes or about 9 minutes. We've the window, actually, though, TDCJ asked very sincerely that they not give them an order to execute after 10 o'clock. However, Paige accurately pointed out that one case that we covered on the show, they didn't begin the execution until 10:20.
Well, that's true, you know, but they don't have him on the gurney and they don't have him strapped down. He's sitting in the holding cell and, he really doesn't know what's going on. Gloria's been on the loudspeaker, telling him that we're out here because he can hear the loudspeaker.
Oh, he can hear the loudspeaker. Okay. That's good.
Ray, Gloria and I are loud.
Yeah, but no, I think there's sufficient evidence for a conviction in that case.
Yes. But we will wait. We will wait until the end, until Mr. Rayford either goes back to the row or the witnesses cross the
street.
Well,
will you speculate?
No.
Okay.
If I was on the Supreme Court, there would be no death row.
You're right. I mean, yeah, but they're not going to give us that opportunity. I hope we never do another show. But while I've got you on the phone, are you going to be up there Thursday for?
Yes, I will be up here. We're hoping for a stay for him.
Wait a minute, we got an incoming call.
But we will be up here, and we're very encouraged. We had three students come from Sam Houston who are very encouraging. It's good to see young people come and want to know what's going on. We invited them for Thursday, and any public that can hear me now, we're always at the walls on an execution day. So contact me or contact Gloria, and we'll get you up here.
And what's the best way to do that?
You can contact us both through Facebook. Gloria runs her big page.
Well, that's Gloria Ruback, an activist friend of mine, a very long standing. I mean, Gloria's got some miles on her as an activist.
And yes, and she runs the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. You can go to her Facebook page and contact her any time, and you can contact me through my page of Pat Hartwell.
Well, Pat, we here on Execution Watch hope your stay in Huntsville is a waste of time, because we hope that there is no execution tonight as you do. And so we're going to sign off and close out the show here in a few minutes.
I'll talk to you Thursday.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, bye-bye.
My name is Ray Hill. What you've been listening to for the last 55 minutes has been Execution Watch. It's a show that we do in real time of the execution live on radio station KPFT. We are carried over the Internet on executionwatch.org. If you go to executionwatch.org, you will find that every show we have ever done is there. This show, when it is put up, and it'll be put up in a few hours, it is available immediately on kpft.org's archive. But when the show's over, we will put this on executionwatch.org as an audio show. The reason it is not a video of tonight's execution is Mr. Rayford did not accept their invitation to be interviewed for this broadcast. We send invitations to every inmate whose name appears on the scheduled execution list, and we invite them, if they want to be interviewed during this show, we will go up ahead of time and do that. That will happen Thursday, so we will not only have the videotape of that interview, but this entire show will be videotaped, and all of that will be spliced together. You can go to our website and see both videos and audio coverages of people executed in Texas. It's not always what you want to hear if you're an abolitionist, because we kind of do it like straight news, and some people are a little bit put off by that, but the fact of the matter is, our job is to put a light on what the state of Texas is doing in your name and let you make the decision of whether you want that to continue or not. I want to thank the legal crew who worked hard to have enough material to keep this program going tonight. And that includes Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, Jack Lee, and, of course, Paige Yannick, who is sitting here next to me, who teaches me how to pronounce Battaglia. And that is scheduled for Thursday.
Yes, Mr. Battaglia.
Our executive producer is Elizabeth Stein, who makes everything work. Our technical director is Otis McClay, which melds radio with the Internet so that it can get to you. Bob Gardner handles our board when we're on the air. The music you're hearing in the background is sung by Victoria Panetti. And Victoria's brother is still on death row. He's a mental case. And they get somewhat confused every time they schedule him for execution. But so far he's alive, and so far she is working to help him every way that we can. I am Ray Hill. I've been doing this probably too long. But I keep on doing it, not because I love it. I do it, actually, I don't like it. I don't like doing the show. But I think it is a journalistic responsibility for us to undertake. So thank you, Bob. And we're going to sign off and let Victoria have the rest of it. Some announcements from KPFT, and we'll see you Thursday night, literally.